But now I'll just introduce our speaker. So Sandra Bloodworth will be presenting the talk today. Sandra has been a socialist for many, many years and has written extensively on the question of women's oppression and women's liberation. She's on the editorial committee of the Marxist Left Review, which is a theoretical journal published twice a year. And I've just picked out a few copies here up the front that include articles that Sandra has written pertaining to women. So there's one about Marx and Engels on women, one looking at the roots of sexual violence, and then one in the latest edition, which is a more thorough investigation of Engels' work looking at the origins of women's oppression. So if you'd like to have a look at any of these, just definitely come up at the end and flick through them. And you can purchase any of these from the bookstore, which is just outside here in the foyer. But now I'll pass to Sandra.
Okay, well, I wanted to start by mentioning that next year it will be 50 years since there was a court decision in Australia that women should get equal pay. The next year, the first Women's Liberation Movement meeting was convened, and Germaine Greer's infamous book, The Female Eunuch, hit the headlines, with women reporting that they had to hide it from their husbands. Everyone in the 60s was talking about women drinking in public bars. This was a famous protest. And burning bras and miniskirts were a huge controversy. But by 1969, we were all wearing the miniskirts. Now today, there's a lot more open discussion about sexism than there was then. And yet, we still live with all-pervasive sexism which blights women's lives. Sexualized images which objectify women as sex objects are everywhere, whether it's in the TV, in movies, in the books you read, and the incredibly massive porn and sex industry that propagates all these images. And you get a glimpse of the consequences of this belittling and sidelining of women in the stories which have flooded the Me Too hashtag. And I think women everywhere can identify with the accounts of men using sexual harassment and worse to control women beneath them that they regard as their underlings. So you think of industries where lots of women work, such as retail and hospitality, where people know that bosses both overtly or just subtly demand certain kinds of dress, or that you're not allowed to object if the customers treat you as a sex object. And even if you're not one of the 50% of women who report having experienced sexual harassment, you do live with an ever-present sexism. For instance, surveys have always shown that in conversations, both men and women tend to listen to and take more seriously all the things that men want to talk about. And men introduce the majority or the overwhelming majority of topics that get discussed. Now, you know, one of the things we're looking at is why should this be the case after all these years of campaigning, and even before that women were campaigning for women's rights? Well, the socialisation into the gender stereotypes of outgoing, demanding males and quiet, compliant females starts at birth. Young girls learn at a very early age that they will be judged by their appearance rather than their abilities. And the very earliest books that children are introduced to there's been a survey of them, of the picture books that young, you know, quite little children are given. Of the top 100 bestsellers, 69% had a male lead character, but then of the others, they were more likely to have no lead character rather than a female lead character. Six of them had all female characters, and 31 had all male. And like if I spent the time talking about the way the characters are portrayed, the situation's even worse. And so a lot of sexism in everyday life is hardly recognised by most men, and even lots of women. Our identity as men and women is so integrated into our worldview of ourselves and of the people around us that the sexist stereotypes, they just seem natural most of the time. And so I want to put up this slide an old, I think it's in the late 70s, I'm not sure when it's from, but you can see the slogans and demands have hardly changed over all these years. So the hypocritical emphasis in the media of, on the way they emphasise strangers murdering and attacking women in the streets, while at the same time publishing sexist photos and stories all the time, all of this helps obscure the experience of the more insidious sexism, inequalities which are harder to define and more difficult to confront. For one thing, most sexual abuse of women is carried out by men they know, such as their partner, family members, friends, you name it. Because boys, fed that diet of images which demean women and deny them agency, become men with a sense of entitlement, a confidence to dominate women in their lives and expect that sex is about gratification of their desires with no regard for women. 45 years since the women's liberation movement began to openly discuss women's sexual desires and pleasure, everything in society still denies it. So even women themselves can find it very difficult to assert their own needs and desires in intimate situations with men. And so when scandals like the university colleges, which I presume everyone's seen, hit the headlines about all those rituals they have of demeaning and abusing women, there's always calls to change the culture. And it usually means the culture of those colleges, as though they live in some bubble outside this society. But more importantly, there's very little in way of any serious propositions of how you would change the culture, either of within the colleges or, in particular, of the whole society which breeds it in the first place. So to find solutions, we actually have to understand the system which breeds this sexism. But where do we start? It seems difficult to know where. Well, I always begin with exploitation, the legal bedrock of capitalism. Exploitation isn't just about being illegally underpaid. Exploitation is the basis of all class societies. It means that a small minority who have control over the productive wealth of society, the land, the raw materials, factories and the like, they live off the unpaid labour of the majority. Now, this was easier to see in a society like feudalism, where the peasants either worked for some of the week on the landlord's land, or they just handed over some of what they produced. Now, under capitalism, it's much more difficult to understand and to recognise exploitation, because we seem to be paid for the whole working day. Because labour power, which is our ability to work, is just another commodity on the market, and its price is set by that market, not by the value of the things that we might produce. And as Marx said, if workers were paid for all the value they produce, in that case, no surplus value or surplus product, whatever, would go to the capitalists. Here then, he says, we come to the rub. What would capitalists live on? So we work for part of the day for nothing, producing profits for the bosses, just like the feudal peasants. And every worker is exploited and every boss is an exploiter. So figures from the Australian Bureau of Statistics illustrate this exploitation. This is only for industries, healthcare and social assistance, where women, large numbers of women are. Every worker produced an extra $24,300 above their wage in 2016. And the graphic shows that the orange part is what went to the bosses for their profits. Now, to maintain a system based on this kind of theft, the majority have to be oppressed. They have to feel less entitled to a decent life than that minority living off that extra wealth. As John Lennon of the Beatles begins his ballad, A Working Class Hero, as soon as you're born, they make you feel small. And then groups which can feel even smaller because they're weighed down by the experience of more oppression than just that class oppression will feel even less confident to assert their rights in a decent life. And further, women who can be migrants, Muslims, lesbian or transgender, Indigenous women who suffer racism, cultural disrespect, the effects of the stolen generations and much more, all live with a complex combination of different forms of oppression. And I just want to go back to this, like the first one, I just want to keep emphasising that when we talk of the category women, we have women of all different backgrounds and different countries in mind. Now, it can seem that the oppressors are men or racists or bigots who we might work beside or meet in the supermarket, but we need to be clear. They are not the cause of oppression. They reflect the impact of this system. The stereotypes are so embedded in the very way capitalism works. So, for instance, in the 19th century, the capitalist class had to find a way of reproducing the workforce because it was at as little cost to themselves as possible, because in the Industrial Revolution, men, women and children worked extraordinarily long hours in terrible conditions, and so children, who were the future workers to be exploited, were dying at an alarming rate. And so the capitalists, backed up by middle-class supporters, did everything they could to push workers into families which mirrored their own. A male, you know, aggressive male, going out, preparing, providing for the family, whereas the woman's place was in the home to nurture and raise the next generation. And they hoped to be at the beck and call of the men. Now, for most workers, this wasn't actually the reality most of the time. Working class women have always worked in one way or another. Nevertheless, the ideal of the family entrenched sexist stereotypes passed down from pre-capitalist societies. So they're so embedded in our whole cultural history that people recognise them in all kinds of ways. But they were moulded to sort of to suit the needs of capitalism. So they had to be slightly different from the past. So, for instance, but that doesn't mean that then they're set in concrete. They actually can change again and again in various ways. So when I was growing up in the 1950s, the most dominant stereotype was women as housewives. Prudery and the two images of goddess or whore blighted people's sex lives. And like sex in itself was regarded as dirty, something secret, and so all portrayals of sex were regarded as pornography. And so people led, very horrible lives. And to get hold of pornography, you had to know where to ask for it under the counter. But then the sexual liberation movement in the West opened the possibilities of more meaningful and varied relationships and the entry of women into more seriously full-time work on a mass scale brought some more independence for women. And so the stereotypes actually have changed quite dramatically, because the sexualized objectifying portrayals of women's bodies, which we see everywhere, are quite different, but they do not represent the the goal that we had in mind when we had talked about sexual liberation. Actually, they emphasize the idea that women are sex objects for men's gratification, reinforcing the age-old stereotypes of femininity and masculinity. And in different cultures and different times, these stereotypes can manifest in quite a lot of different ways, but in the end, the final result is a very similar message. So I would argue that this strongly suggests that women can only be liberated once class society is overthrown, and that means capitalism today. So to start thinking about what we can do, we need to recognise, I think, a couple of important points. First, in as far as any of the exploited accept sexist, racist or homophobic ideas, it creates divisions amongst those who aren't part of the exploiters and makes it that much more difficult to stand up for our rights and to struggle for things such as demanding a decent wage, equality, decent housing and whatever. And secondly, without digging very deep, I think we can easily see that capitalists, those exploiters, depend on us docilely going to work and accepting shit conditions so that they maximise their profits. So they are the only ones who benefit from these oppressions, and in particular sexism we're talking about. Because the sexism undermines women's confidence as well to be able to organise and to stand up, as well as the divisions it creates amongst workers. So you might ask, why do people who aren't capitalists mouth these horrible ideas, which are obviously against their own interests? Well, in Capital, Marx explains the effect of the reality of work and production in capitalism. He pointed out that the starting point is that we don't actually have control over our labour power, which is really the basis for our, is central to our humanity. Workers produce things not because they know someone needs them or wants them or they want them, but because a capitalist hopes to make a profit by selling them on the market. Where they don't know who will ever use them. When we buy products, we don't know who produced them or in what conditions. And so the economic and social relationships between human beings are just appear to be organised by the market, government departments, courts and the like. And so all of this it puts a whole shrouds or what are human relationships behind a veil of mystification. And so there's two consequences from this. Firstly, it's very difficult to work out how the system does work. And most people, feeling dominated by uncontrollable forces, feel powerless and unable to change anything much. So the mystification of the system and how it works, the sense of powerlessness breeds passivity and subservience to figures of authority who, by definition, are purveyors of the capitalist ideology. So it's not that people are just stupid or that they're duped by the right-wing media and a whole lot of bigots, although they play a role in, you know, propagating them and we try to fight their influence. But the fundamental reason that people accept them is because of these very real material circumstances that are inherent in the structures of capitalism. And it's quite realistic to feel powerless because without organisation and struggle, we are powerless. But we need to look further than that. The images and their sexist meanings take root because they both reflect and then they reinforce the reality of this society. The way capitalism is structured ensures that women aren't just thought to be unequal, they actually are unequal. And go back to this is the iconic image from the next family court ruling 3 years later that we've tried to actually implement equal pay, and yet nearly 50 years later, we have a pay gap between men and women of 17%, and in Australia it's rising again after some years of narrowing. Male graduates are expected to earn around $1.5 million more over their working lives than women, which still seems extraordinary. They have the same qualifications. So why, you might ask, is it so hard to breach this gap? Well, the fundamental answer is that savings from paying women less go directly into the pockets and the offshore bank accounts of business owners. So there's actually an incentive built into the very system to have as many workers as possible paid less than, you know, than they are entitled to, and to keep their wages down. But that's not the whole picture, because there's a bit of a circular process then happening between sexist assumptions and those material factors. Bosses expect women to do particular jobs and not others. And then those stereotypes also affect the subjects that women decide to study at university, and then they end up in industries dominated by women, which are automatically lower paid than where men dominate. And even in campaigns to get women into less stereotypical courses, people, including women, fall back on sexist arguments. The female president of the Engineers Australia in South Australia said in a campaign last year to get more women into engineering, "People think we're either constructing roads or bridges. There's no sense of, if I became a biomedical engineer, I could help someone who can't talk." So we fall back on, you know, women don't want to be building things, but of course they do want to help people. And because of that image of the ideal family, even though fewer and fewer people live in it, it seems quite natural to virtually everyone that women will be responsible for children. So about half of women in the paid workforce are part-time. And the most common reason given is childcare. So the ABS declares that they choose part-time work. But what might they choose if there was quality free childcare available? No one asks that question. And fathers who want to share responsibility for children often find that they simply can't. Firstly, because wage is likely to be more than the mother's, and so the family can't afford to sacrifice their wage. But even if they do, employers then resist because men's requests to take time off to for family business and stuff, it's always resisted and regarded as unnatural, whereas, you know, it's taken for granted that women will end up having to take off that sort of time. And so then that in turn means that bosses don't want to employ women in particular positions and don't want to promote them when they have young children. And a story in the Sydney Morning Herald recently actually illustrated the boss's prejudices. A highly skilled and experienced woman with a 15-month-old child was asked in job interviews if her head's really ready to go back to work and was thoroughly grilled about her childcare arrangements. Her husband had never been asked about his mental state or whether he had good childcare arrangements. So there's no way around it. Sexism is absolutely integral to capitalism. Women's unequal pay is worth trillions to the world's capitalist class, and the caring that they do in the family is worth billions as well. So changing the culture involves more than just demanding that men in our lives change their sexist ways, which socialists are for doing, and we argue about it in Socialist Alternative, expect high levels of behaviour from the men in our organisation. But, you know, that's not just to make our lives better, but because of the things I've said, that if anyway, when men accept sexist ideas, just as when workers embrace racism or homophobia, they actually make make it so much harder to do anything about this rotten system that we're confronted with. So to challenge capitalism and to raise the possibility of women's liberation, we need unity and power. That's why these divisions are so important to the capitalists. And workers actually have the power to bring the system down. They actually make all the wealth, which makes the profits. But, of course, they don't recognise it most of the time. And it's the case that they do have the capacity to unite. All the slogans of the workers' movement are about the need for solidarity and unity. And this slogan, "Workers United Will Never Be Defeated," is one of the most popular. Now, it's not as though it's just automatic, as we can tell, that workers are exercising their power and all united, but at times it means confronting men's divisive ideas. But if they're organised in strong unions, it's often easier to win them around these questions than, say, students, who people assume will be more enlightened because they're being educated, but the students don't have the experience of class solidarity that good trade unionists have. But wherever we are, I think, standing up to the system which relies on oppression for its existence, that's our starting point for how we are going to deal with women's oppression. And it's not just about fighting for women's rights. Every time people campaign against this society, whether it's for refugee rights, for free education, LGBTIQ rights, or higher and more equal wages, whatever, everyone, really, to have success, needs to build as much unity as possible. But here I want to pause before I move to finish, because the popular slogan at women's marches is often "Women United Will Never Be Defeated." But actually, all women can't unite, because half of that class who live off our unpaid labour are women. If we take the two richest women in the world this year, now, it's true that they're only 17th and 18th on the list of the richest, but I'm not advocating you shed a tear for them, and I'm not for campaigning to narrow the gender pay gap in their class, because the billions that they get all come from our exploitation. So Françoise Bettencourt-Myers, she's the heiress to the L'Oréal cosmetics fortune, with a net worth of $43.9 billion. So she lives off wealth made in an industry that encourages women to obsess about their appearance and, feeds off our oppression. Alice Walton, heir to the fortune of the retail giant Walmart in the US, she has $46.6 billion US dollars made by paying a mostly female workforce miserable wages. Gina Rinehart, he's Australia's richest. I'm sure she's a hate figure in this room. Her wealth is nearly doubled last year from $10.7 to $20.9 billion. Now, she says that Australian workers should work for $2 a day because that's what Africans get. So she recently called for a lower minimum wage. And she suggested that poor Australians should just cut down on their drinking, smoking and socialising if they want to get rich. And it's not just the rich and the right wing. You might think that getting more Labor women into prominent positions in government would actually take us forward, but you only get to the top of government if you accept that you will rule in the interests of the capitalist class, not for those of us who vote for them. So Julia Gillard won fame in 2013 with her popular misogyny speech when, as Labor Prime Minister, she got stuck into Tony Abbott. A masterful, righteous takedown, said The Guardian. But as women everywhere were feeling, you know, a little bit better about things because she took this stand, she set in train new rules for the single parents payment, which reduced the incomes of more than 100,000 sole parents, and as we know, most would be women, by up to $100 a week. Her government refused to get rid of all the anti-union laws, which make it very difficult to fight for the rights of the most vulnerable, which is often women, and she steadfastly opposed equal marriage. So, to begin to finish and make my main point. Let's think for a minute about how society would have to be organised if we were to have equality for, you know, virtually everyone. Marx argued that we would have to have the attitude that to each according to their needs, from each according... Sorry, I've said it around the wrong way. You've got it on the wall. From each according to their ability, to each according to their needs. Now, so any time out of work for childcare and family care and all the rest of it by either women or men would not result in a reduction in lifetime earnings and opportunities. These activities would be valued and production would be organised around them. Those who need extra resources in order to participate fully, women and men with children, those caring for the elderly, those who actually suffer a disability or illness, for whatever reason, that can't participate fully in the workforce, would get all the resources and the backing that they need to participate in society. You only got to think about it for a few minutes to realise that this means capitalism has to go to have a society that is based on this principle. But as soon as you talk about overthrowing capitalism, there's always people who say, oh, yeah, you just want to hang around, wait for a revolution. You know, we're getting our hands dirty fighting for reforms. Well, actually, socialists are the most determined fighters for reforms because we do know that in spite of oppression and lots of difficulties, we can win reforms, and the ones that we've won have often been led by the fight's been led by socialists. But we need to remember that they are usually inadequate and very precarious, that at any time they can be lost. And when I think about those 50 years time span, I think of both sides of the question. Divorce, when I was young, was extremely difficult until 1972. But even today, when it's, you know, legally reasonably easy, it's not always that easy to leave a partner because of difficulties with money, social pressures or lack of support, lack of housing, all kinds of reasons. In 1969, a court ruling ruled that in limited circumstances in Australia, abortion could be legal. And yet we're still waiting for Queensland to fully legalise it. I can't remember all the other states, but wherever, whether it's legal or illegal, services are completely inadequate. Tasmania basically doesn't have any provision of abortion at the moment. In 1972, the single mother's pension was introduced. It did later become available for all single parents, but Julia Gillard's attacks were only the last of a whole line of neoliberal cuts to it. We had virtually no childcare other than our parents and, you know, friends, but it's still so expensive and inadequate. It's not a reality for lots of working class people. We won some refuges for women escaping domestic violence, but government attacks everywhere have really gutted their availability. Now, I could just go on with the whole list, but you get the picture that fighting for reforms is simply not enough. So how can we fight to end women's oppression? Well, the sentiment expressed by Tarneen Onus-Williams, the Aboriginal woman who chaired The Invasion Day rally in Melbourne this year, I think, is a good start. I always feel that I won't give her justice in the way she declared it. Fuck Australia, she said. I hope it burns to the ground. And, you know, so, you know, I think that's got to be our long-term goal, that we've got to... we actually have to bring the whole system down. But that will only become possible if we can build movements that are so fantastically mighty against all injustice that's meted out to us and others. And those movements can only be built by standing up for ourselves and for all the oppressed against injustice, even if the numbers we mobilise sometimes are not as great as we would like. So that's why we chant on demonstrations, if anyone is under attack, stand up, fight back. Now, there are traditions of women fighting in trade unions and in social movements for the whole of capitalism's history. From the fight for the right to vote and many more, the vote was first raised here in Australia by women who had been participating in the Eureka Stockade of 1854. The fight for equal pay by trade unionists, both women and men, stretching over decades before the final court decisions. And we need to keep alive that tradition of working class solidarity, demanding that men fight for women's rights alongside us, but that all of us are fighting for all the oppressed. And the struggle, because the struggle to win reforms isn't just about winning reforms, even though that's important. The experience of fighting together, of sometimes winning an occasional reform, this can transform people's consciousness. But the most important point is it builds confidence. It pushes back against that sense of powerlessness that I started with. And it is the only way that we can push back that and give people the confidence to reject the ideas of capitalism and feel the strength to be able to push back against it. Women can feel more confident and develop skills that they never thought were possible. And men can begin to see how stupid and divisive their ridiculous ideas of sexism and the behaviour are, and they can begin to change their ways. And you can see a lot of this in this slide of a union rally in Melbourne against the cuts to the penalty rates. Now, this was organised by the strong unions in the building industry, who organised mainly men and who weren't affected by the cuts, because they have a higher level of consciousness and a recognition of the need to fight of unity with the most oppressed. Precisely because they have strong organisation and they have a history of fighting for their rights. If we, these teachers, and there's a talk about them later from Dana from America, they're in West Virginia and they won big pay rises earlier this year through big strikes. And one of them told an interviewer, "I'm thrilled. I feel my life won't ever be the same again. It sounds like hyperbole, but it's not. Going back to the classroom won't be the same now." And I tell you, 40 years ago, when I first, it was the first arrest I had and confronted police in illegal marches and stuff in Queensland, I felt exactly the same way. And I also observed it when I participated in this strike with migrant women in Melbourne. I was just a newly recruited socialist and learning about working class struggle, and these women were such an inspiration to me that I wrote a little pamphlet about it. You can probably get on the bookshelf. So what was the next point? Yeah, so anyway, I'm going to finish with a range of photos from a range of struggles, because I feel that the images actually make the points that I want to make more eloquently than words that I can find. Because here we have no sexualized objectification of women, but strong, confident women with men following their lead. Men and women from many different backgrounds united in struggle. The racist caricatures that blight people of colour's lives are absent. These were early childhood workers all out on strike. So to undermine sexism or to win women's rights and equality just now, actually, these are the kinds of struggles we need. But we need to use these struggles to build movements that are so determined and so centred on the strength of organised workers that this experience of unity dominates the mass of people's lives instead of the demeaning images which belittle and objectify women everywhere. And then that would be the basis for a movement that could bring the system down, and that strength and unity and solidarity that had been built up, that lays the basis for a totally new society to operate on the principle that Marx outlined for human liberation for all.